Good afternoon. Bonjour. My name is Suzanne Morton, and I'm the acting director at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. It's a real pleasure to be able to welcome you here today to the William R. Eakin Lecture. This year, we're particularly lucky to have our second Eakin Fellow, Dr. Cheryl Suzik from the University of Toronto, who will be delivering the lecture entitled Reparatory Justice, Human Rights, and Indigenous Feminisms. This term, the lecture is going to take somewhat of a different format because, in fact, we have two presentations. Professor Bruce Dutu from the Native Study American Studies program at Dartmouth College will deliver a second lecture entitled Of Guardian and Wards, Tribal Sovereignty and the Limits of Legal Pluralism. At this point, I want to give my sincere thanks to the Faculty of Law and the Department of Political Science who helped make this possible with their support. I will formally introduce Cheryl in just a moment, but first I'd like to say a special thank you to the Eakin family for their generous and ongoing contribution to this university. In particular, the creation of the Eakin Visiting Fellowship in Canadian Studies to honor William R. Eakin has brought some 9 scholars so far, and we're really pleased to be welcoming 2 additional ones next year to MISC for 1 or 2 terms. The previous fellows have included Ian Mackay from Queen's, Elspeth Cameron from the University of Toronto, Andrew Holman from Bridgewater State University, and Karen Fricker from the University of London. And that's just to name but a few. It's a very distinguished alumni. On behalf of the Faculty of Arts and, of course, MISC, I'd like to thank the Eakin family for their outstanding support to McGill. As well as being this term's Eakin Fellow, Cheryl Suzik is an assistant professor of English and was educated at the University of Guelph and the University of Alberta. Her research explores the intersection between Indigenous law and literature with a focus on Indigenous women's writings in the post-civil rights period. She's co-editor and contributor to Indigenous Women and Feminism, Politics, Activism, and Culture, published by the University of British Columbia Press in 2010, co-editor of Law Literature Post-Coloniality, AREL, a Review of International English Literature, and a contributor to a special issue of South Atlantic Quarterly, Sovereignty, Indigeneity, and the Law, which was voted best special issue in 2011 by the Council of Editors of Learned Journals. She is in the final stages of completing a book manuscript entitled Indigenous Women's Writings and the Cultural Study of Law. Well, come on in, and there's some seats over here too. Cheryl is cross-appointed to the Aboriginal Studies program and teaches courses for English and Aboriginal Studies on comparative literature, Indigenous literatures, comparative Indigenous studies, and Indigenous decolonization with a focus on gender issues and women's issues. Her teaching and research interests include Indigenous literatures, studies of law and literature, post-colonial feminist theory, and legal writing. This year, Cheryl has been teaching CAN Studies 405, Traditional Justice in Indigenous Communities, and it's been a fabulous feedback from the students in her class. I'd like to welcome Dr. Suzak.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, for that very warm welcome and introduction. I too would like to add my voice to the thanks and to express my gratitude to the Eakin family for their generosity, especially to Professor Desmond Morton and to Ms. Gail Eakin for the support. Also to the McGill University community, which has welcomed me, the Department of English, MISC, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and especially to my students in CAN 405, who've been incredibly energetic and warm and interesting, and have advised me that I may put away my winter coat in May. So thank you. I'm going to read my lecture today. I tend to be very, very focused on text for the expression of my ideas. And I'm also going to show a few slides. I think I am. to kind of pull together the ideas that I want to talk about today. I'm talking about, under the umbrella term, discussing Indigenous agency with my colleague and a scholar I very much admire, Professor Dutu from Dartmouth College. I'm absolutely delighted to be here with him. I've learned so much from his work and have been really indebted to him for the forward thinking that he brings to the study of law, which has impacted my own work in really important ways. Oops. The title of my talk is Discussing Indigenous Agency. Thank you very much. Discussing Indigenous Agency, Reparatory Justice, Human Rights, and Indigenous Feminisms. Indigenous women in Canada are participating in self-determination struggles through forms of activism that may be best characterized as active silence. They are taking on roles that facilitate community regeneration according to the principles of kinship respect and intergenerational inheritance and renewal by working behind the scenes to build local sovereignty in ways that facilitate Indigenous social justice claims. In this talk, I present two case study examples of women's local activism in order to trace a trajectory of change by Indigenous women that is emerging within Indigenous communities. This trajectory calls attention to the need for new forms of understanding about how sovereignty issues and gender concerns are co-implicated in ways that do not fit with prior models of feminist or Indigenous sovereignty analysis. By so departing from prior forms, these innovations are calling for a new language to theorize Indigenous women's gender agency. I will propose the term active silence as a concept that articulates women's agency in order to show its connection to Indigenous self-determination. My working definition, as you can see from the slide, my working definition of self-determination is drawn from Val Napoleon's distinction between self-determination and self-government. Self-determination, she argues, represents a two-part process. On the one hand, it represents the right of an Aboriginal nation to choose how it will be governed. On the other, it is grounded by the collective power of choice. Self-government, in contrast, represents one possible result of the choice to be self-determining. Napoleon notes that although self-determination is a principle of the highest order within the international system, its meaning and application remain bitterly contested by nation-states and Indigenous peoples. It has been proposed to encompass all aspects of human development and interaction and to establish a complex of inextricably related rights which are interdependent, where no one aspect is paramount over any other. It is a right that forms the basis of all other rights, she argues. Self-determination also expresses an entitlement that Indigenous peoples bear to negotiate their status and form of representation with existing states. Within the human rights regime, Indigenous self-determination is the core concept that grounds and articulates a new source of Indigenous rights. These rights are expressed as human rights to culture, in which culture is understood as a capacity held by both peoples and persons to engage in, and as a basic component of human dignity. Cindy Holder defines this shift in international legal fora in three ways. Culture is treated as an activity rather than a good or object. Culture is taken to be as basic a component of human dignity as our freedom of movement, freedom of speech, and freedom from torture. And cultural rights can be understood only against the background of a basic right to self-determination. Despite recognition of Indigenous self-determination and culture rights, Indigenous communities confront the constant erosion of their self-determination practices by both state and international forums. This erosion occurs because legal and state institutions do epistemic violence to Indigenous communities in two ways. One, through the discursive framing of the legal personality of Indigenous peoples, and two, because self-determination struggles are viewed through a historical presentism that tends to erase the historical past in foregrounding future-oriented policies that omit recognition of local Indigenous self-determination practices. Mark Frank argues that state and international discourses demonstrate a conclusionary logic in the way they describe indigenous communities that adds to indigenous struggles by conceiving of them as blank slates in which three conditions prevail. One, they have no inherent authority to contest state incursions. Two, their self-identity is constrained by a focus on cultural rights determined through the historical colonial encounter to the exclusion of contemporary practices. And three, their local sovereignty remains unrecognized by national and international objectives that prioritize state development. A concept such as active silence addresses this erosion by calling attention to other forms of organizing and resistance in which indigenous communities have engaged to assert their self-determination practices and their local and historical embeddedness. Active silence also articulates a different framework for indigenous self-determination, a framework that is not solely dependent on legal mechanisms. Active silence and decolonizing. The term active silence has been formulated by Deborah Bird Rose as a concept that captures the ideological and material implications of historical erasure in two ways. One, as a passive condition in which indigenous subjects consent to their erasure even as their historical and contemporary presence continues. And two, as a form of decolonizing through which conquest practices embedded in institutions aim toward reversing the effects of colonization actually amplify existing colonial relations through practices that reconfigure and erase indigenous life ways. Active silence contributes to indigenous self-determination struggles, then, by raising questions about women's knowledge claims and their gender contributions to decolonization struggles. It does so because it addresses these concerns by drawing attention to women's experiences while also opening up the historical record to new forms of knowledge recovery. Framed another way, the concept politicizes through gender analysis the foundational goals of indigenous decolonization processes in their engagement with the issues of voice and agency by preventing the legal personality of indigenous peoples, a term I borrow from Mark Frank, from defaulting to a universal stance. That is, it accords race and gender identity to the historical narrative by establishing a politics of reciprocity and equivalence. Indigenous peoples continue to exist, therefore they have existed in the past, therefore they have resisted in the past, becomes a kind of corollary relationship that one can see in the historical record. Case study one, the Satu Dene and Port Radium Uranium Mine. The community of Delaney Northwest Territories has a Dene population of 800 people. It is located on the shore of Satu, Great Bear Lake, about 300 miles north of Yellowknife Northwest Territories. It is the only tribe and the only human community on this lake. Satu is the ninth largest in the world and the fifth largest in Canada. The area on the north shore of Satu has been the site of extensive mining practices. Radium mining from 1934 to 1939, uranium mining from 1943 to 1962, and silver mining from 1962 to 1982. The Dene of Delaney, mostly men, worked as laborers carrying gunny sacks of radioactive uranium ore and concentrates on the transportation route. Tons of tailings from both radium and uranium mining were dumped directly into the lake and used as landfill. Port Radium was owned and operated by a Crown Corporation of the Government of Canada. Uranium ore and concentrates were extracted, milled, and sold to the United States government for the Manhattan Project. Because of the subsistence livelihood which continues to date, the Dene people travel extensively on seasonal and rotational bases around the lake, following their main food source, the caribou and the fish. Not just the men, but families were generally exposed to the various waste landfills and lake dumps over the years. They were not warned about the hazardous nature of these ores and tailings and took no precaution with respect to working with this toxic substance, their drinking water, or their traditional foods. It is only recently that the Dene of Delaney were informed of these exposures. They have been advised of hot spots of radioactivity in the Sawmill Bay area, one of the areas for which they traded other territory in their land claims agreement because of its subsistence priority use. In 1998, a delegation of Dene elders, traditional leaders, and community activists traveled from their remote community of Delaney to Tokyo, Japan, to participate in ceremonies commemorating the victims of the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima during the Second World War. Their purpose was to apologize for their unwitting role in mining the uranium that went into making the atomic bombs. The journey, captured on film by Peter Blow in his documentary, The Village of Widows, tells the story of their travels, reception, and participation in commemorative events. It also describes the long-term effects of mining for the Delaney community, effects that Blow characterizes as creating a village of widows due to the devastating impact of cancer-causing agents, which killed two generations of men involved in the mining operation. As part of their attempts to recover from the impact of these losses, the traditional women of the community invited Blow to record the story of their 20-year struggle to persuade the Canadian government to clean up the tailings that pollute the water sources and lands surrounding the community, as well as to document their public apology for participating in these devastating events. Case study 2, Enbridge's Northern Gateway Project and Bella Bella Resistance. The Northern Gateway Pipeline Project is a proposal by Canadian oil and gas company Enbridge to build two pipelines stretching 1,177 kilometers from the Alberta oil sands to the west coast. The pipeline's capacity would transport 525,000 barrels of oil per day. The cost is $6.5 billion and would consist of two pipelines, one transporting oil in a westerly direction from Bruderheim, Alberta, to the port of Kitimat, B.C. From Kitimat, the oil would be shipped to international markets in Asia and the northwestern United States. A second pipeline would carry imported natural gas condensate in the opposite direction. The condensate is a toxic mix of liquid hydrocarbons that form during the extraction of natural gas and are used as a thinning agent to dilute and help transport heavy oils like bitumen. The majority of the pipeline would be buried underground, with the exception of a few water crossings where it has been deemed safe to run pipes above water. This project would also require the building of a new marine terminal in Kitimat. Local Indigenous communities oppose the pipeline. They argue with environmental groups, local fishermen, and municipalities that the process pollutes the air and nearby lakes, rivers, streams, and watersheds, destroying wildlife habitats and releasing large amounts of greenhouse gases that threaten surrounding communities. Local activist Jesse Housty has been at the forefront of organizing community resistance. Jesse is the director of traditional ecological knowledge for the Quest Project Society. She founded this style Memorial Library in Bella Bella, and she was a finalist in 2010 for the EcoTrust Indigenous Leadership Award. Jesse began raising awareness about the threat to local communities more than 3 years ago through education initiatives that focused on tankers and pipelines. Jesse tells stories at local community events about oil companies, pipelines, and tankers, and how they don't get along. They're actually combatants. And whenever they don't get along, someone suffers, and usually it's the human community that, in fact, will suffer the consequences of their failure to agree. Initial events that Jesse organized brought out 2 to 3 people. A few months later, 400 people were coming out, and subsequently, by spring of the following year, most of the community was attending the local organizing that she had undertaken. The objective of each event was to instill pride in culture and support for each other within the community. I think I have just enough time to show you a short video clip from the community. Oh, you know what? That's not the right one. Sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. This is not the clip I wanted to show you. The clip I wanted to show you was the calling off of the commissioner's visit to Bella Bella, where they argued that they were unsafe and that there was protest.
I'm here to give my personal testimony to you, the Joint Review Panel, on a subject of hate culture.
I'm so sorry. Please let me continue. The short clip is actually showing Bella Bella people coming out to greet the commissioners. What they did was they held a protest, a hunger strike. The children held a protest in the school to indicate their lack of support for the pipeline. The commissioners saw this as a kind of resistance that threatened them, and they called into question their safety and canceled the meetings. So I'll make the clip available for anyone who's interested. I'm telling you these two stories of different kinds of local activism supported by Indigenous women, called into being by Indigenous women, in order to raise the following concerns. These are the concerns that it seems to me the local activism by women have brought into view for us. And they have to do with a series of questions that are being asked. The questions are, how is the intangible as a way of life made tangible in government terms? How is Indigenous knowledge being forced to be translated into government language so that the government can understand an Indigenous place in history and in society? How is it possible to find creative ways to set deep cultural knowledge into a format that commissioners can hear? How can you find a language to frame the things that are true for you so that they can be communicated and understood? How do you overcome the fundamental unwillingness to understand that these things are true for you? That is, how do you undo commissioner resistance to the idea that Indigenous peoples practice life ways that are valuable and important to protect? How do you theorize the ethical reckoning between insider and outsider cultural knowledge systems? And how do you reconcile the place of insider-outsider status? That is to say, if these issues are not part of your identity, they are only academic for you. You can opt out of having to make a choice about whether or not you care about these issues. People who live in closer proximity to them can't afford to opt out of these debates or these kinds of local activism. We know from social justice literature that reparations are one way of addressing the issues that Indigenous peoples raise. We know specifically from an incredibly important author such as Rudy Teitel, who argues in Transitional Justice that reparatory justice obligates the state to balance a competing set of interests in redressing victims of state wrongs. Reparations for Teitel are both rituals of incorporation and social acknowledgments of wrongdoing that are required to restore to the victim what has been taken from that person. This is a restoration that works at all levels of the social order. It's about identity, it's about status, it's about material wealth, it's about reputation, it's about public acknowledgement of what has been done to this person and the apology on the part of society for the loss that individual has suffered. The case studies here represent forms of enduring injustice that have roots in the past yet continue into the present. Enduring injustice can only be addressed by taking history into account when speaking about injustice. They can only be addressed by the liberal state if the liberal state understands that historical injustice continues to have a historical and present resonance. I have been arguing that Indigenous women are best placed to speak to this injustice as they live out its enduring harms in the losses of kinship relations, in losses to the environment, in losses that they suffer and experience intimately. To my mind, then, Indigenous women are best placed to speak to these experiences and to voice the implications for themselves and for the victims and their descendants. Thank you.
We have an opportunity for 10 minutes of questioning specifically on this portion of the lecture, and then we'll move on, and maybe in the end we can bring things together. But we have the opportunity for questions, and traditionally we give the first question to any students. So if there's a student who would like to pose, and if they'd like to come to the mic, that would be fabulous. Thank you. There's two mics, one in the middle and one over here.
Hey, thanks for your talk. That was really awesome. I just have a question. You talk about the idea of deculturing language. When you talk about that, are you talking specifically about like English as like a colonial language form? Are you talking about needing to translate things into government terms? And I'm just wondering, like, do you have any thoughts about how to communicate in not using deculturing language?
Thank you, Molly. Molly Swain, CAN 405. I think it's a really important question that you're asking, and a really difficult question, because what you brush up against is, in fact, the idea that because Indigenous peoples are located in the hierarchy in a secondary position, they're not their terms that they're allowed to bring forward, but they're constantly translating their language, their knowledge, their terms into language that someone else can understand. They're seldom awarded any kind of recognition for the act of translation that they enter into. They're seldom given the kind of cultural literacy or political literacy or social literacy that they're actually engaging in. It's not recognized, it's not thanked, it's not respected, it's not acknowledged. And this is a dilemma that we have, where Indigenous peoples do the work for other places or other peoples in society and are constantly called upon to do that work time and again, with little acknowledgement that the burden falls to them because they are the people who have been disempowered in society. And I've often been inspired by speaking to people from Indigenous communities that I've had the good fortune to meet. Jesse Housty is one of those people who've articulated principles and concepts for me that have helped me to change my thinking, but have also helped me develop a language, a cultural literacy that can, in fact, empower in institutions. One of the expressions that Jesse Housty uses is a kind of it's a mindset that follows from the idea that because Indigenous peoples have little, the perception is that they deserve little, and it follows from that that what they're given or what they're offered is often so much less than other communities are offered, and there's no explanation as to why that's the case. There's no recognition that, in fact, as people with complex cultures, societies, politics, legal systems, institutions, histories, the recognition has just never come their way. And I think decolonizing that mindset is probably one of the most difficult problems that Indigenous peoples encounter time and again.
Then we can open, if you'd like to come to the mic.
Yes, I was wondering whether the characterization or the loss of self-determination, as you describe, for Indigenous people, is that specific. I understood you gave a very particular case, an extraordinarily interesting one. But I was wondering whether the same principle applies to non-Indigenous minorities. And I'll give you a very current counterexample, that is that of the Rohingya peoples in Myanmar, who recently have been dispossessed of their identity in a very, very peculiar way by simply taking their rights of participating in the census, which is one means of one means of imposing one's or showing one's identity. And that erasure that you described seems very inherent here. It's almost as if these people who supposedly are not native to Myanmar are supposedly being suppressed and removed. Now, I was wondering if there's anything peculiar or any particularities of the situation that you describe that are only specific to Indigenous peoples compared to non-Indigenous minorities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great question. I would ask, if it's okay with you, to shift the language you've used from self-determination to justice. And the reason I would ask for that change or that shift in placement within language is to suggest that the idea you're drawing attention to, as I understand it, is that there is a contemporary injustice that has been suffered by a community, and that contemporary injustice requires reparation of some kind. And I would say, yes, absolutely. Contemporary injustice should be addressed. There's no question about it. But one has to have a complicated idea or a complicated notion of what kind of justice one is asking for. Indigenous people suffer from contemporary injustice that is linked to historical injustice that has to do with ongoing injustice. So the justice demands that they should be permitted to make and that should be answered for in regard to what they call for should be more complex and should be more historically informed. They should be wide-ranging in terms of what Indigenous peoples are saying about how they suffer. If there are present injustices, as a society, of course we should care about them, but we should be clear that Indigenous peoples occupy a particular place in society based on historical injustice and based on the fact that that is an enduring injustice that continues for them. What it also should open up for us is the idea that that injustice will continue into the future, and are we prepared to stand back and let that happen becomes then the real, quite an urgent issue. But I don't know much about the example you've raised, but I would say absolutely that should be brought forward as a justice issue, perhaps not as a self-determination issue, but as one that can have real social implications tied to it as a justice issue.
I'm going to be controversial. Traditionally, discussions on human rights issues involved notions of right and wrong, justice and injustice. Unfortunately, they rarely describe the realities on the ground, where you have a dominant group taking advantage of its wealth and power to exploit a minority group, historical or otherwise. And so I wonder, in the meantime, that group pays the price of exploitation, of disease, of unemployment, of identity issues, and in many of them face the verge, are on the verge of extinction, while intellectuals and constitutional lawyers dither about the various scenarios that ought to be adopted. And so I'm wondering whether, as a practical matter, as well as ultimately a human right matter, the debate should not be framed on the grounds of the lesser of two evils. In other words, whatever way the situation is going to be resolved, it's never going to be ideal. If we wait for the ideal, one group may not live long enough to even come close. So I'm suggesting, and this is why I said controversial, whether the debate ought not to be changed to discussion of what are the lesser of evils, what is the minimal amount that can be salvaged and that might do some good on the ground.
Thank you for your question. I had the humbling experience a couple of years ago of being invited to the University of Western Ontario for a transitional justice conference. And it was a humbling experience because I'm a literary scholar by training and an Aboriginal studies professor and literary scholar in practice, teaching the institution. What was humbling about it was meeting with other people who do field work, who go to places like Uganda, Afghanistan, war-torn countries, South Africa, who participate in truth commissions and hear stories of violence done within those countries and have to come up with answers to the violence that occurs. And what I was struck by in the stories, one was, wow, what was I doing at this conference? What a big mistake. And two, what was I going to do to make my presence, justify my presence at the conference? What was I going to talk about? And I ended up going back to literature I had read early on in my graduate degree on the residential school system before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission came into being. And I was humbled by what Indigenous authors were saying about what residential schools did to those communities, what they did to them in terms of grief, suffering, pain. And what I ended up talking about at that conference was this idea that Indigenous peoples in Canada, in the West, face a dilemma. We can't say to the people we are trying to convince of our the way we've been treated, the way we've been discriminated against, the way that injustice has occurred, we can't show the mass grave sites because those mass grave sites have been covered over. We can't say, well, we've lost our children, those children have been taken from us and they have ruined our communities. We've suffered and kept that grief private and hidden confidential, not spoken out about it because the pain is too real and because for the most part people don't want to hear. Or we've brushed up against the problem that there has been no civil unrest in Canada to sort of throw into profile the kinds of conflicts, the kinds of crises, the kinds of violences that have been done to Indigenous peoples. So speaking to activists and intellectuals who've actually been to these places is a problem of how to talk about what's been done to Indigenous peoples when you cannot show the bodies, when you cannot show the photographs, when you cannot show the mass desecration of communities or of buildings, or you can't ruin society to prove your point, and one doesn't want to. What does one do? In that regard, what you're asking then is for the translation of Indigenous issues into a language, which is a heightened, amplified language, and an immediate and important language. Yes, something should be done. Of course something should be done. Of course basic needs should be met. Of course security of the person should be immediately established. Of course the appropriate resources should be brought. If Indigenous peoples, though, can't speak in that language, doesn't our urgency matter? Don't our concerns have some kind of critical value or political weight? Aren't they just as important if we suffer in silence? If we can't say, well, here's the war, here's the violence, here's the mass civil unrest, are we not also deserving of the same humanity we would attribute to those who suffered as we would reach out to those who suffered? This is the point I was trying to make about... I'm not sure that I follow exactly.
We use it as an excuse not to do anything by saying, yes, we've been awful and bad in the past, we're sorry, we shouldn't have done it, and then we go on doing the bad things in the present and the future. That's the part that bothers me. We use the excuse of injustice, past injustice, to legitimate what's happening now.
Okay, I don't think that's what Indigenous communities are saying. I don't think that's what my talk was trying to say.
No, but that's what's happening. That's the point. I know that's not your intention, but I'm suggesting in actual practice that is what is happening. And in the time...
I think we need to address the talk because we have very little time. We have one more person at the mic, and this is a conversation that can happen over maybe a glass of wine at the end.
Happy to.
Perhaps a slightly less controversial question.
Okay.
I'm a bit young, so I don't have much historical proof here, but I've been coming to Canada for 10 years, and I have a lot of experience in the Thompson-Nicola Valley in British Columbia, interior British Columbia. Now, I know that there's quite a large population of Indigenous people there as well, and there's a bunch of reserves all around the area where you can see these communities thriving, some of them more than the others. Now, my point here is that Indigenous people in the area are known for everything from excessive drug abuse to growing marijuana and stuff like that, everything to violence and all the categories of crime and whatnot that are socially deemed unacceptable and just generally not right. So this violence is sometimes proposed by the Indigenous people as well. So what I'm trying to ask here is, do you propose that we need a new system of how we interact with the Indigenous people in the first place? Because the way things are working now, as in the example of Thompson-Nicola Valley, people aren't working together because there's just way too much hostility because of historical examples, as you yourself said. But if we take that away, if we have a new system, do you think that will work? Is that what's the key to the successful talks in the future? That's, yes.
I'm boldly optimistic about a new system. Absolutely, no question about it. I'd love to know what it looks like. I'd love to have examples, models, ideas, conversations, absolutely. I think the youth
is
are...
Is there such a system? That's more, I guess, the question.
Exactly. That would be more difficult. And I think in that regard, I would just reiterate what I already said, which is that you have to historicize violence and injustice. You have to ask Indigenous peoples what answers they would like to see proposed. You'd have to consult, and you'd have to have the people who've suffered play a part in the answer that you want to propose. More than that, I haven't been able to think through or imagine or, you know, come up with.
How do you explain these Indigenous people then leasing off their land for 90 years or so to build skiing resorts like Sun Peaks and whatnot? This is a business. They're okay. Making money. So if they're going to treat, if they're going to do this, you know, we need equality here. We need to all be fair to each other. So we need to treat everybody positively. We need to treat everybody equally. So what I'm trying to say is, how would you make that system work? How would you treat the Indigenous people? How would you suggest for the Indigenous people to treat us to make this work?
How would Indigenous people treat the majority community? Okay, this is a direction I haven't thought through, but let me give you a slightly different answer to the question you're asking very quickly. No one asks Indigenous peoples what they think about international relations. No one asks Indigenous peoples if they believe in humanitarian aid. No one asks Indigenous peoples what they think about justice or how they might imagine it. No one consults with them about their ideas, their intellect, their wisdom, their commitments. They treat them as an object or as something that has to be controlled, managed, understood. They don't see them as real people. I think any dynamic that establishes and objectifies Indigenous peoples is always going to misunderstand and misrecognize what Indigenous peoples have endured and the legacies that they've come from. If you're speaking about violence as a kind of wide net that you would cast over Indigenous communities, every community has violence within it. One needs to understand violence in a historical form, in a social form, in a political form. One need not racialize it by saying Indigenous peoples are substance abusers or Indigenous peoples are committed to violence. And one might also stop and think that maybe the answers to many of these problems are with Indigenous peoples, but no one's bothered to ask. So I think that's as much as I could say. Thank you. Thank you.
Cheryl, thank you very, very much for that stimulating talk, and I'm sure it will continue on after during the reception. It's a real pleasure now to be able to introduce our second speaker. Professor Bruce Dutu is an internationally recognized scholar of Native American law and policy. He joined the regular faculty at Dartmouth in 2008 as professor in Native American studies. Prior to joining the Dartmouth faculty, Professor Dutu was on the Faculty of Law at Vermont Law School. He served as the law school's vice dean for academic affairs and was director of the VLS Sun Yat-sen University Partnership in Environmental Law in China. He served as visiting professor at Harvard, Universities of Guangdong in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, and the University of Trento in Northern Italy. He's the author of many, many books, American Indians and Law, Handbook of Federal Indian Law, and has contributed widely to other books in chapter form. He also has published extensively in many legal reviews, and I will not list them all, but it's certainly very, very impressive. He has also published commentaries in the public press, the New York Times, the New York Post, and the Navajo Times. And so it's a real pleasure to be able to welcome you to here to McGill, to Montreal, and to participate in the Ekin Lecture today. Professor Dutu.
I won't have any slides because I don't know how to do PowerPoint. So it's an easy thing.
Thank you very, very much, and I want to echo Cheryl's thanks to the Ekin family, to McGill, to everyone associated with organizing this conference. My wife and I had the pleasure of driving up from Vermont to Montreal last Saturday, so we had the lovely weather from yesterday that we shared with you. We've had much of the same, so we can commiserate. So thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. My talk in this lecture under the rubric of Indigenous Agency is of guardians and wards, tribal sovereignty, and the limits of legal pluralism. Most of my remarks are coming from a chapter in my most recent book called Shadow Nations, Tribal Sovereignty and the Limits of Legal Pluralism. And in this talk, and what I do in this chapter, is I focus on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's what I'll do briefly this afternoon. I want to focus on the Supreme Court's work and its jurisprudence in federal Indian law, is how we refer to this body of law, in two dimensions. One is to call attention to the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court stands in quite a distinct position from its co-equal branches of the federal government, the Congress and the executive branch. In this way, while the political branches in the last 40 years or so have embraced, for the most part, not only the concept but the reality of self-determination for Indian tribes, and you can point to a series of legislation passed by the Congress, funded by the Congress, supported by every president, Since Richard Nixon, and many of my students are surprised to hear that Richard Nixon was the author of so many of these quite progressive policies. But the Supreme Court stands in contradistinction to this. They're the ones putting the clamps on tribal self-determination. They're the ones constraining tribal self-determination. And I want to explore a bit about why, and also how. So the how part of the talk is what I do in this chapter, and what I'll do in this talk is to look at how the court has used a couple of very distinct legal principles, concepts of dependency and incorporation. For the last 150 years, those words have appeared quite regularly in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, but they have not been given the same meaning. In fact, they've morphed over the years, so that today, in the modern era, those terms take on a certain lethality. They're not helpful. In fact, they're quite deadening to tribes. In December of just last year, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the one case before the court that deals with tribal sovereign issue. It relates to a case brought by the Babe Mills Band of Ojibwe Indians in Michigan, and what's at stake potentially is the tribe's sovereign immunity. Now, the federal government, the states, are sovereign from suit, as are Indian tribes. But for the last 30 to 35 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it quite clear that whenever this issue has been raised in some of its cases, they're not fans of tribal sovereign immunity. And sort of relating to the young man's question a while ago, it's as if the Supreme Court has taken it upon itself to be the self-proclaimed guardian of political outsiders who may find themselves somehow entrapped, ensnared by tribal power, and uncertain about how this power is going to be visited on them. What are you going to do if I'm ensnared by the grip of tribal power? What will you do to me? The Supreme Court itself has articulated time and again and expressed concerns about the brand of justice that exists within and emerges within tribal governmental structures. They talk about customs and traditions, foreign languages. We don't know what the non-native speaker will experience there. Perhaps they should do a field trip. Perhaps they should leave Washington. Perhaps they should talk to tribes and see what kinds of justice is actually operating there. So in lieu of that, they're operating on fear. And they're also operating on something that we have been very, very reluctant to do for 200 years in the U.S., and that's share. It's one thing to share land, share resources. We haven't been very good at that either. But one thing we are very, very reluctant to do is share power. And this is what this boils down to. The gentleman's question here, which I fully applaud and support, we're down to the fundamental issue of power. Whether Indian tribes should be recognized as having it, and what are they going to do with it? And most particularly, what are they going to do to us? the non-native community. I'm a native person. I don't have big worries about that, but I also am concerned about if I happen to be in some other tribe's network, I want to know what the brand of justice is there. These are the sorts of conversations we're having. Well, let me take you back to December of just last year in this Bay Mills case. At one point during the oral arguments, there's been no decision in this case yet. We expect it any day now. The Solicitor General, that's the lawyer for the U.S. government, when it was his turn to address the court, cited to one of the landmark cases in U.S. history, Worcester versus Georgia, 1832, in which the Supreme Court acknowledged the sovereign status of Indian tribes. And those were the terms that the solicitor used. He says, as the justices know, in 1832, Worcester versus Georgia recognized Indian tribes as sovereign nations. And he was immediately interrupted by Chief Justice John Roberts, who said, quasi-sovereign. And then helpfully, Ruth Bader Ginsburg chimed in and says, dependent sovereigns. It's like they couldn't wait to add a modifier to sovereign. Now, for those of us who read the tea leaves and think that every single joke or gesture that a Supreme Court justice utters from the bench is somehow significant, we pay lots of attention to these kinds of words. Why the necessity to clarify? First of all, who listens to oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court besides lawyers and the parties and an occasional media person? The general public doesn't pay attention to that. It's hard to follow the logic of a Supreme Court oral argument. In fact, you can read a bunch of transcripts, and I dare say you would quickly lose sight about what's being fought about. Who are the parties? What's the issue? Is this even the U.S. Supreme Court we're talking about? But why the need to go back and insert the terms quasi or dependent? Makes a lot of sense if you understand that those terms, and particularly the term dependency, has had the kind of lethal authority that I trace in the fourth chapter of this book called Shadow Nations. Well, how did the court first use this term dependency, and how is it using it now? The first person to use it was John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, in these opinions, in Cherokee Nation versus Georgia and in Worcester versus Georgia. He described tribes as being domestic dependent nations. Domestic dependent nations. The domestic portion of this had to do with a territorial reality that whatever power tribes might enjoy and continue to exercise will take place within lands now claimed by a new sovereign, the head sovereign, the U.S., as successor to the British crown. So domestic part has to do with territoriality. Dependent had to do with political authority. And John Marshall had a very specific interpretation or framework within which he understood dependency. And he was borrowing a page from international law, where he was looking at alliances that smaller nations might link up with larger nations to protect both their political and territorial integrity. Treaties, where small nations line up with bigger nations to have their back, pure and simple, is protection. We know this because there was a dissenting opinion by Justice Thompson. We also know that Justice Marshall asked Justice Thompson to publish his dissenting opinion, in part because they knew there was another case coming up right the very next year, Worcester versus Georgia, where Marshall probably anticipated he was going to use some of this language now that the jurisdictional impediment that prevented the court from reaching the issue, the merits, in Cherokee Nation were removed when the court heard the Worcester decision. And if you put Thompson's dissenting opinion from 1831 side by side with Marshall's majority opinion in 1832, you can see a lot of copying. I won't call it plagiarism. He was just borrowing from his justice, his fellow justice, and citing almost word for word the language about dependency being traced to international precepts about what happens when weak nations or smaller nations line up with bigger nations for protecting their territorial and political integrity. Now, they both cite Vattel, a leading international law figure. They don't give us examples. You know, which nations did you have in mind? They assume you can go read Vattel to see which nations he had in mind. But that was Marshall's understanding of dependency. Tribes, far from shedding their sovereignty, are actually exercising their sovereignty when they engage in treaty making with other political bodies to safeguard the political and territorial integrity. Now, before I leave the court in 1830s to go to the court in the latter part of the 19th century, it is important to know that many, if not all, members of the Supreme Court harbored the view of Native peoples shared by most folks in power in the early part of the 19th century. In my first book, American Indians and the Law, I call this the dying Indian thesis. They all subscribe to it. They all expected that Native peoples, as a people, were doomed. So why bother with the niceties of political arrangements for one side who's going to be gone in one generation? This idea about the imminent death of Native peoples took a bit of a bizarre or a somewhat macabre twist in 1913, just as an example, where Congress appropriated money to purchase and set aside land on what is now Staten Island, where they were going to dedicate a memorial to the departed race. There's actually a drawing, an architectural rendering of what was going to be constructed. It would be a statue of a young brave, hand held up, sort of like, it's been real. Had it been built, this thing would have been about 15 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty. There's a big part of me that really wishes this thing would have been built. So we'd have a constant reminder about the obsession with burying Native people. We already know that there is a bit of an obsession about burying the memory, as the gentleman said. It's not a pretty history. And for many Americans, it's better left forgotten. So here you would have had a statue that everyone would have to talk about at some point, because it's standing right there in the harbor. Lady Liberty on one side and a tombstone on the other. So, dependency. What happens at the latter part of the 19th century? Well, by the latter part of the 19th century, most of the major wars with tribal communities have been fought and won. The military balance of power clearly shifts in favor of the federal government. Tribes are basically domesticated. And in fact, that shift is reflected in the architecture of the tribes of the federal government, where the responsibility for managing Indian relations in about 1849 moves from the Department of War, as it was known as at the time, to the Department of the Interior. I always like to show a graph for my students about who else is in the Department of the Interior today. Fish and Wildlife, Minerals Management, National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management. Basically, all of our natural resources, the birds, the bees, and Indians. So if you just look at the architecture of federal power and how and where Indian affairs fits, not within their own cabinet office, not within at least the Department of State, as I have argued. If you're not going to get your own cabinet, you should at least be in the department that does relations with other governments. That's a Department of State. Not other natural resources. But that's where they are. Dependency. The court has taken, by the latter part of the 19th century, a very different spin on this idea of dependency. They're not referencing. In fact, some of the cases of the latter part of the 19th century don't even cite the Cherokee cases. They're using dependency in what I call the factual dependency context. Indians are poor, they're destitute, they're helpless, and we are responsible for their welfare. In fact, in 1886, in a case called United States versus Kagama, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that responsibility, this trust obligation the obligation of a superior culture to bring about an improvement of the inferior culture rooted in Christian ideology. This is the good thing to do. They recognize that as a separate and distinct source of authority, of power, separate and distinct from the U.S. Constitution. And for several decades after that, dependency essentially gave the U.S. Congress carte blanche to do whatever it wanted to do in the name of elevating the stature of Native peoples. Well, elevating the status of Native peoples was code for assimilation, changing radically their way of life, their land systems, religious practices, dress, language, even kinship structures. This is the era, late 19th, early 20th century. Indian children are pulled away from their homes, sent to boarding schools, hundreds, thousands of miles away. A full frontal assault on indigenous peoples in the U.S., not ended until 1934. Now, I won't bore you with all of the other nuances of dependency, but the court arrives in the modern era with this viewpoint of Native peoples as dependent nations and Congress having a massive authority called plenary power in U.S. constitutional law. There are only two areas of U.S. constitutional jurisprudence where the court regularly calls Congress's power plenary: immigration policy and Indian law. And the functional consequence of that is that the U.S. Congress is still assumed by the U.S. Supreme Court to be able to do just about anything under its constitutional power. And this dependency notion has now been given a constitutional sanctuary. That is to say, the one and only provision of the Constitution that speaks to Congress's authority in Indian affairs, the so-called Indian Commerce Clause, in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, there's a listing in Section 8 of the various powers of the Congress. One of them is to regulate commerce with the foreign nations, the several states, and with the Indian tribes. With the Indian tribes, not of the Indian tribes. Now, sometimes my law students and students would say, wow, you're making a big deal out of that word, with. So, well, that's what you do as lawyers. Words matter. Words matter. And when it says Congress regulates commerce with the Indian tribes, it connotes a certain bilateralism, not a unilateralism, that allows Congress to essentially develop an idea about what's best for Native peoples and then implement that without any kind of limits, except self-limit. That was the situation until recently. In the last several years, some interesting things have happened, and I want to close with this because we're not sure how this is going to unfold. And this sort of relates back to the young man's question here about what happens if this power, beyond being a source of social organization and political authority within the community, what if it's turned to outsiders? Non-natives, maybe even non-member Indians, so Native people who live on another tribe's reserve or reservation. What are the constraints there? Well, one continuing tension here is a long-standing rule of law that Indian tribes, in the exercise of powers of self-governance, are not limited by or subject to the constraints of the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, or the Bill of Rights. Tribes are both pre- and extra-constitutional. They existed before the formation of the United States government and continue to subsist outside the framework of that liberal democratic framework. And yet, the court has also held, despite being outsiders, they are still insiders in terms of being subjected to Congress's plenary authority. Now, that paradox can only be worked out if you put it in the context of a the legacy of colonialism. That is, these peoples who are viewed as different, inferior, less than, etc., still need the tempering hand of the benevolent overseer guardian. We still have to watch out for them, because not because they are small nations, It's because they're inferior people who are going to die eventually. But in the modern era, surprisingly, much to the court's surprise, Congress has done some remarkable things. In 1978, for example, the Supreme Court decided a case called Oliphant versus Suquamish. Very, very controversial opinion. I've written a number of times. I see it as the most controversial opinion of the modern era. Why? There's a simple issue in that case. And the simple issue in Oliphant was whether or not Indian tribes, in the exercise of their sovereign authority, have the power to criminally prosecute non-Indians. Mr. Oliphant punched a cop, tribal cop, in the face, in the nose. And he challenged not just the exercise of the tribe's power. He didn't wait for a trial. He went to federal court using the writ of habeas corpus that's included within a federal statute called the Indian Civil Rights Act, which Congress passed in 1968, that basically was an imposed system on tribes to say, when you do exercise self-governance, you have to play by this rule book, which is essentially our rule book. And we provide a ticket for people who are challenging the legality of their detention in tribal court. This is how Mark Oliphant ended up in federal court. He says, I don't think tribes have the power to prosecute white people. And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. A few years later, another person, this time a tribal member but of a different tribe, challenged the tribal court's power. He says, look, I am a political outsider just like Mr. Oliphant. Just because I'm native shouldn't matter. I'm deprived of whatever kind of political participation rights that members get in their tribal community. So therefore, the court should similarly hold that I am a political outsider and therefore not subject to the tribe's inherent criminal authority. And the Supreme Court agreed. But here was an interesting response. Within 6 months, the U.S. Congress acceded to the demands of tribal leaders, their advocates and supporters to say, okay, the hemorrhaging of tribal power at the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court needs to stop. The court in Oliphant recognized a theory called implicit divestiture, which arrogated power onto the court to determine what's in and what's out. It basically unleashed a very, very lethal doctrine in the hands of the courts now to determine what's in and without tribal authority. But Congress changed this. They overruled that second decision that I just described, which is named Duro versus Reyna. They overruled it and said that non-member Indians are subject to the tribe's criminal jurisdiction. Now, there was also an effort to overrule Oliphant as well. And that's where personal politics can get in the way. There was a very, very powerful U.S. Senator, Slade Gordon, who was representing the state of Washington, which is where the Oliphant case came from. And Slade Gordon, during those years in the 1970s, was the Attorney General. Before he was a U.S. Senator, he was the Attorney General of the state of Washington. He had been beaten up several times, not physically, directly, but his office, in the fishing rights cases. Time and time again, the state of Washington challenged the interpretation of fishing treaties, and they lost just about all of them. But Oliphant was a signature and singular victory. We finally got the Indians. They can't prosecute white folks, so they can take the fish, but they're not going to get one of us in jail. Now, he's a U.S. Senator, and he chairs the Senate Finance Committee, one of the most powerful committees on the Hill. And word got out that these Indian agitators wanted to overrule both Oliphant and Duro to fully restore what we call territorial sovereignty. You know, here I am in your lovely city. If I went out there and stole something or mugged one of you and then said, ha ha, I'm not a Canadian citizen, I'm an outsider, therefore you cannot prosecute me. How far would I get with that argument? Not past this room. But it works in Indian country. In the U.S., it works in Indian country. It works in Indian country. So, Slade Gordon heard that there was a move afoot to overrule both Duro and Oliphant. And the word was sent out. I don't really care what you do with Duro. Tribes can prosecute all Indians. I don't really care. But Oliphant doesn't get touched. And if any senator expects favorable treatment from my committee, and remember, he chairs the Senate Finance Committee. If you expect to bring home some bacon from Washington, it starts at that committee, and you had better not support an overrule of Oliphant. So Oliphant was dropped from the bill. That's what happened. Political power, political pressure. Fast forward to 2013. Last year, President Obama signs a reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. This law had been a subject to reauthorization for some time, and members of Congress sought the opportunity to do a partial repeal of Oliphant because of a serious problem of sexual violence against Native women in Indian country, where the vast majority of offenders, we know, according to the U.S.'s own data, are non-Indians. Think of it this way. The government's closest to the problem can't do anything about the problem. A woman calls 911 on the res. And it's not, are you safe and so forth, it's who was the offender? Was he white or was he Indian? Are you white or Indian? Did the crime take place in Indian country? Can you imagine being interrogated, sort of like a first-year law student, when you're reporting a crime? That's what goes on. And so, to address that, members of Congress wanted to introduce a bill that would be tagged on to VAWA to provide for a limited slice of jurisdiction for Indian tribes to be able to prosecute any offender for three crimes. Domestic violence, which includes forms of assault, stalking, and violations of protective orders. That's it. Everything else is still, you know, Oliphant is still the law. So if you're going to commit arson or burglary and so forth, and if you're a white guy, odds are pretty good you're going to get away with it because the tribe can't prosecute and the feds and the states are busy fighting terrorists, and so they could care less. They just don't prosecute. They just don't prosecute, and the data is there to support that. But this was very, very, okay? Are you okay? This was very, very upsetting to many people, so that in 2012, when VAWA was first up for reauthorization, it stalled. It stalled in the Congress in large part, not solely, but in large part because of this provision that would recognize an inherent source of authority for Indian tribes. Now, it passed last year, but that was because Congress included all kinds of provisions to guarantee that offenders would face a trial in a system, a tribal system, that operated and looked for all intents and purposes just like a state or federal body. In other words, they legislatively said the U.S. Constitution will apply, the Bill of Rights will apply, the tribal advocate must be a law-trained lawyer, the judge adjudicating that case must be a law-trained judge. In other words, the answer was eliminate any vestige of pluralism. That was Congress's answer. Or another way to look at it is the price for being able to have this power restored is the elimination of any distinctive feature of your indigenous adjudication system. Now, some folks declared victory, closed up shop, and went home. I still have a hard time seeing VAWA's reauthorization as a victory because I'm concerned about the price that tribes who are going to exercise this authority will have to pay. And it's all a function of this concept of dependency and the wide, broad license that it authorizes the federal government to exercise. So even when Congress is wearing kind of the cowboy white hat, they're still doing something quite destructive. They're still imposing an assimilationist mindset to say, we will recognize this expression of your inherent powers, but only if it looks like something we can tolerate. If it's too far off the cuff, you're simply not going to be able to do it, and Oliphant remains the law. So, in conclusion, I think that these notions of dependency, this idea of incorporation that tribes are physically embraced and ensconced within someone else's authority, the sovereignty of the U.S. government, means that we still have this intense high level of scrutiny, and maybe appropriately enough, for tribes. But the problem is, what are the constraints on the federal government from continuing to go down the road where they will now, in the name of recognition, in the name of recognizing greater tribal authority, demand that the tribes adapt and modify its juridical systems so that they may be recognizable to outsiders but utterly unrecognizable to the indigenous peoples whose very systems they began as? So I'm not sure how that story will play out, but that is where we are currently in terms of the court's handling of this notion of dependency, and I will be open to any questions that you may have at this time. Do we have time for questions?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was a really fascinating talk. And I was interested in your use of the term colonialism because, you know, I also know that, you know, there are such things as territorial dependencies, right? And I was wondering what the relation is between the shift in the semantics between, you know, from the early to late 19th century and the advent of colonialism of, you know, Guam and Puerto Rico.
Yeah, yeah. So in my book, so I think you're talking about the court's shift in the late 19th century. It's pretty clear that the U.S. began its own course of imperialism, both domestically and abroad, during the latter part of the 19th century. At the latter part of the 19th century, the U.S. began to experience waves of immigration from other nations, Eastern Europe, and also from China. And that caused great alarm in the U.S. in terms of, well, who are these people coming in? And are they going to sort of assimilate and buy into the, you know, the melting pot theory and so forth? There, one of the cases, again, I can go into this detail in the book. It would be deadly boring to do it in an oral presentation, but since you asked, I'll answer. One of the cases that the court decided that used this concept of dependency is one that references that shift, that history, but in the most oblique form. The case is Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock. Some of you may know this. 1903. It stands for the principle that the federal government unilaterally can abrogate treaties with Indian tribes so they can break their word. But there's a soft, what I call a soft caveat in the Lone Wolf decision. And the soft caveat says, if circumstances warrant, or if there are exigencies that demand that the nation abrogate its word with Indian tribes, then it's okay. But they never tell us, in that case, what was the exigency? These are tribes that were challenging a policy, the allotment policy, that was going to destroy the land base of Indian tribes, and it ultimately led to the loss of two-thirds of the tribal land base, this allotment era, because it opened up Indian lands for homesteading by white folks. And so they never tell us in that case, except parenthetically. There's a reference in the case that says, as with treaties with foreign nations, parentheses, and they cite a case, the Chinese exclusion case, close parentheses, the government may, you know, there could be some circumstances that happen that warrant us taking that case. Well, if we could click on that Chinese exclusion case, what we would find, it's a case of Chai Chan Ping versus the United States. Mr. Ping was a Chinese national living and working in California who had gotten all the papers to go back to China to visit his family and was on his way back. Now, this is a period of a long time. While he's gone, the U.S. unilaterally abrogates its treaty with China on immigration policy. And if you read the testimonials introduced by the legislators from California, in support of why Congress should do this, they're talking about how the Chinese are just taking over. One representative called it an Oriental invasion. Others said, you know, that they're just different than our forebears who came from Western Europe. These folks are different because they still insist on speaking their language. They still live in accordance with their own values and principles. They live together. In other words, they're not following the script that says you assimilate. Now, I tell my students, if the principle was we have broken faith with a bunch of foreign nations, so we could have picked a treaty that we broke with France, with Canada, I'm sure we've always kept our word with your country, with England, with whoever, we could have picked any treaty, but why did the court pick that treaty, that case? And that was their oblique way to say the tribes represent the same danger, the same threat. They refuse to assimilate. They're not getting with the program. And the penalty for that is a government running roughshod over a population over which it's empiring at will with the law's sanction. And so I trace that as a sort of a colonial response because there's just no way you can justify that under the Constitution. Now here's an irony, the supreme irony, when the history catches up with you, and you know, you almost have to laugh at some of these cases because they are just the tragicomic dimension of some of these cases is such. In the modern era, twice now, the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down legislation of the U.S. Congress when it comes to land rights and this problem of what we call the fractionated property interests. So here's what was happening with these allotments, you know, during this era of allotment. So we destroy the tribal communal land system and instead give them 160 acres of their own piece of the earth to develop a capitalist ethos and, you know, be private owners and so forth. That's the path to civilization. When that person dies, his heirs get the property and then their heirs get the property and so forth. So now you'll have people who own 1/5,000th interest in a small acre in some place in South Dakota. And if you want to lease that land, develop water, develop anything, try going around and getting all of them to sign. The land is practically valueless. So Congress wrote a law to say, you know, it was called the Indian Land Consolidation Act. It basically said, look, when the value of your interest falls below a certain value, and I think it was fairly minimal, that land will escheat to the tribe. That's a way to kind of get those small portions together so someone can do something useful with that. The Supreme Court struck those down as violating the Fifth Amendment's the takings clause, that the government was somehow taking the interest of the native people. Where was the Fifth Amendment 100 years ago when 90 million acres was taken and the court didn't blink? But they're worried about a $200 parcel interest as invoking. That's what I mean, the tragicomic dimensions of this, to say you folks really don't get the big picture, do you? Question.
It'll have to be a quick one.
Okay. Oh, see, I
rattle on too much, sorry. Basikaduigan dulwe abwaliwalaug, nina marshati care deluisi, listigushtlewe, nigedl kinamasiulet at McGill University, PhD, edlugwedem.
So, having said that, I want to say that words are important, too. I spoke in my native language, which is Mi'kmaq. Yes, it might be considered one of the ones that is going extinct. So, I stand here today to actually thank my grandparents first. My grandfather was a World War II veteran, and so he had the option to voluntarily enfranchise. I also stand here today, and I thank my parents, because during that time, when it was not the right thing, the appropriate thing to do, to teach Mi'kmaq to your children, they actually did. I also want to thank MIST for this organizing this event, and also for the Mohawk people. We're on their traditional territory, and I just wanted to acknowledge and thank them. So you had actually touched upon my question that I was going to ask in terms of assimilation. And it reminded me of a quote from Vindaloria, who said, "The problem in communication between non-Indians and Indians is that they're talking about two different perspectives." And so when I think about this and I think about assimilation and cultural identity, I always wonder how best to go about describing that to non-Indigenous people. How do you describe that your identity, for instance, if I take myself as an example, a Mi'kmaq woman, how do I relate that my legal identity is being determined from someone that I don't have control over? And this is actually important for two reasons. As a mother, I have one child, my eldest child. Mm-hmm. He actually has legal identity as being Mi'kmaq, whereas my youngest child doesn't. So it's always difficult, or it's always a conversation when I bring that forth. And I just wanted to know what your opinions or your perspectives were on that. And so if I am to be forgotten, I want everyone here to remember and to have learned or to have heard my language.
Thank you very much.
Madeline de Lucy Tiffany. I'm learning from Marcia, so that was just really touching too. And so I guess my question is, how can we creatively navigate through the law in ways that, I just thought in terms of the case that you were talking about in terms of the treaty with China, and how one of my friends who is Haitian was like telling me about this this community who started or who found that they had a lot of similarities with Haitian immigrants, that they actually adopted them into their community because they had those rights of membership and deciding what kind of membership they had. So I found that really inspiring, and I want to know maybe a hopeful nugget mm-hmm. that we can bring out about how we can navigate in those ways. So
thank you. Yeah, I'll try to make this brief. And thank you both for your questions very much. On the first question on identity, this is a very real challenge in terms of the intersection of cultural identity, something that your local community will acknowledge and see as a constituent member of that community, and what happens when law, outsider law, comes in and has its own definitions, but more important than definitions, its own value system for assessing who is and who is not. Michael Doris, some of you may know the late Michael Doris, was an anthropologist, was one of my mentors at Dartmouth College. And he often wrote about American Indians living in the popular imagination in a certain fixed frame that oftentimes means that we have to adjust and address the frame before we can start talking about the substantive issue, whether it's water rights or our personal liberty interests and so forth, because that's where some of the problems are. If one side is still thinking, but you don't look like an Indian, I get that all the time. I can tell you how many times I've registered the look of disappointment on my audience's face when I walked in and said, oh, that's Professor Dutu. And it's because there's a dissonance in terms of where Indian people live in the popular imagination. You know, we're so sophisticated now with MRIs and all this stuff. There will probably be a test someday that you can sit someone in a room, plug them up with all these wires, and then say, Indian, and the screen will light up with all certain kinds of things. Well, I've actually done little experiments like that. with audiences where I've at grade school, middle school, high school kids and said, I want you to, I give up pens and paper and say, I'm going to say a few words and I want you to draw the first thing that comes to mind. And I will say Indian. And I get teepees and bow and arrows and horses and things like that. It's the Wild West comes alive again. And so if that's where that conception resides, and Cheryl and I both do, well, she's the expert in literature. I'm a sort of charlatan coming in late to the game to talk about the intersection of law and literature. But this is why I'm fascinated with this. Stories that people tell about themselves and about others. And how can we correct the angle of vision so that those stories are more respectful and accurate? So that it's our stories that are being heard and our stories that are being understood for who we are as a people. That's number one. On the other one, I do try to give a nugget of hope to many of my audiences because, you know, when I was a law professor, I taught torts, criminal law, and federal Indian law. And I was known as Professor Doom and Gloom, you know, because people are maiming themselves, they're killing each other, or they're committing genocide in all my courses. And so there's not an uplifting story to be had in my courses. For me, the uplift, though, comes with looking at the fact that despite all the bad news that comes from Washington is that tribal sovereignty on the ground. When I visit tribal communities, I talk to tribal leaders, there is real governance that's taking place out there in Indian country. It's almost as if they didn't read the memo that came from the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh, you mean we're not supposed to be doing that? Well, that's how we're doing it here, because that's what works here. And I love that. I think that that's where I get my hope, is that the communities themselves are carrying that vision. And so oftentimes law, it's happening despite the law, not because of the law. Thank you very much for your attention.
It gives me a great pleasure to be able to thank both Bruce and Cheryl for, I think, a really important presentation. They complemented each other, I think, very, very well. And so I'd like just to express the thanks on behalf of the Eakin family, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, the Faculty of Arts, the Faculty of Law, and the Department of Political Science. And I'd like to also give thanks on your behalf as the audience. I have a very small presentation, but I'd also like to invite everyone to join us with a glass of wine outside.